a miracle. At UGP. Are you ready for a miracle with UGP? Oh, radio is here for you. We're gonna learn something new. Oh, are you ready for a miracle at UGP?
Listening to the Underground Professor, high atop a double rainbow, gaily swinging my feet as it arches over the Hermitage of North Texas's liberal conservative studies. I have my Redskins hat on. Mike Jones won the game. That figures. That's for the Ken McClinton, the exceptional conservative out of Washington, D.C. Hey, guys, welcome. We got a special guest tonight. Zarina is in the other chat room on Blog Talk Radio if you want to join her. And tonight I have Shawn Michael. Did I get your name right?
Yeah, that's
good.
Exactly right.
Because
exactly right.
All their names are after saints, and they're hyphenated, and they sound the same. So his brother's name. So people are always getting them confused, but I got it right, so I win. All right, tonight I have Shawn Michael Pigeon from All Saints Episcopal School, and we're going to talk about France, its history and battle, its the French Maginot lines, Maginot, and we're going to talk about the board game that he invented over that. Zarina, can you hear us okay in the chat room? Light is too bright. Let me get rid of that. How's that? There we go. Yeah, I can't do much about that other one, though.
It just looks like I'm in like an angel from heaven. It's like just streaming down.
There you go. Let's move that.
The light.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Let's see. Maybe I can fix that. Hold on. I don't know if you'll be able to see your papers, huh?
Ah, I'll be fine.
All right. How's that? That'd be better.
That's better.
Oh, now it went to low light mode, though. All right.
I don't think it's going to get better.
Yeah, we might have just made it worse, everybody.
That's all right.
Okay. Hold on.
You don't really need to see my face.
There we go.
Anyway. Yeah. Not something you want to see.
That's why we do radio.
Exactly. Face of radio. I get told that often.
All right. So this young man I know from my church, and he is a child prodigy or a progeny. I'm not sure which, but he's one of those.
I'm a child.
Yes.
At least we can ascertain at least that.
Yeah, he is a progeny. Oh, prayers for Teresa's family. Oh, her aunt passed away. No, don't tell me that. Okay, Teresa's family, everybody. Her aunt passed away this morning from cancer. So we send out our prayers for her and her family, and may the aunt spend perpetual time in his light, and may she enter his heavenly kingdom. Literally just found out. Ah, man, hate to open up a show, Amanda, like that. But, you know, life is like that. It only sucks for those of us who remain. Those that leave, they're actually the winners, and it's hard for us to remember that in his name. So it's bitter to it, sink to it, fill it to you. Amen.
Amen to that.
All right. And by the way, Addie is doing much better. As soon as she'll eat, they're letting her out of the hospital. So I've been there most of the last 2 days for my future daughter-in-law. I'm tired. I slept through church this morning. Normally, I don't do that until the sermon. But today, I didn't even get up for church. I slept all the way through it. Okay, Shawn Michael, Olive and Hendon are here in Athena, but they're on the floor today. We got Shawn Michael, and he's going to talk about some history of French in the battle. And good news for anybody. Thank you. Good news. At the end of the show, we have some French, official French rifles. They're for sale. They've never been fired, only dropped once, and they come with their own white flag. So
that's an incredible deal.
Yes. So that was an old joke when I was in the Air Force.
Yeah. Have you ever seen a picture of a Swiss Army knife and the French Army knife? It just comes up
with a white flag
a toothpick. That's right.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Sean, tell us a little bit about you.
Okay.
Background, plans for education and whatnot, what you're going to do, how you're going to take over the world.
That's a major component.
Have you hooked up with Pinky yet?
I have not.
Okay.
That's another step, maybe another hurdle I have to.
Sean's a little hard to hit.
I have to get through. Mr. Jones is fiddling a little bit with that. The microphone, trying to get my.
Tell me now, Mary. Can you guys hear him better? Zombies.
Zombies. Okay. Well, I'll just speak up a little bit because I can do that. Just a little bit about me. I'm an 18-year-old. I'm a senior at All Saints Episcopal School in Fort Worth, Texas. I was born in Michigan. I was right on the tip of Lake Huron. So that's like if Michigan's like a little palm, it's like right in the thumb there. So
let me point out for everybody on radio that can't see his hand.
Yeah.
That a typical Michigander will hold up their hand. So long or for 4 years. So I actually do that myself. And okay. I've never really lived there, but for parents' weekends. But
yeah.
You're up there near Dearbornistan.
Yeah, I guess so. So it's just like about 40 minutes outside Detroit. So I moved down to here when I was about 6 or 7, and I was enrolled in All Saints Episcopal School. Right now I'm getting ready to apply to some Ivy League colleges. Looking at like Princeton and Yale pretty hard. My brother's at Yale.
Yes.
So
you should go to Harvard and start a rivalry.
Exactly. Or what my brother said is that he could probably get me into Yale a little easier.
Yeah, legacy.
So like a legacy. So that's
well you
that's
should look at Hillsdale option. Too. It's Ivy level and it doesn't take any federal money.
That's
and the statues on that campus are Ronald Reagan and Churchill. You should put that. But only go there if you're ready to study. They say they put it in Hillsdale, Michigan, because it's the coldest spot on earth. And you have to really want to learn to go there.
Exactly. Also, the cold helps that you're not doing anything but studying. Yeah. You're sitting inside the whole time.
That's right. Trapped in.
Yeah, exactly. They're trapping you with the books is the point. So anyways, college applications are going out for that, and that's going to be a real adventure, I should say. Last summer, I took some classes at Harvard Summer School on the Cold War, which is kind of looking into what I want to do post-graduation of high school, and on international cop and cooperation. So
you want to get involved in the Cold War?
Well, and I don't want to get involved in the Cold War, but I do want to study like European history, European politics. I want to go get a PhD in something like that. And then the end goal is to be some kind of like professor or some kind of teacher. Oh, yes.
Look there.
Yes.
That's who's looking at you.
That's better. I'm not talking. You're not my audience right now.
Right.
Sorry. So looking a little bit at European history, European politics, and how that kind of shapes the that honestly a lot of the politics of the day are because what you learn about in the Cold War, at least one of the things that we really one of the things we really stressed about it was it's going to get difficult to try to adjust that camera. One of the things that you really learn about the Cold War is how much it really fundamentally shapes how we view things today, and that's really the biggest takeaway I even took from that class, was just how much the past really does. No, it's not something even that you even really think about, because the Cold War was not that far ago. I mean, it was just it was basically just, 30, 40 years ago. So yeah, that's not history. That's like people lived during that. And so my mom lived during that. So it's really interesting. I am glad
and we can't
she's
edit
not
it.
Sitting
this
here.
Is live
this
radio.
This is live radio. That's not good. But anyways, you don't think about that. And so
she was just a baby. Well,
yeah. I mean, not you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I love you, Mom. So you don't really think about that as in history. But you really see when you dig down into the statistics, you dig down into the themes about how much we're shaped by something that's just very recent. So that's really that was really interesting. But just overall of what I'm kind of wanting to talk about today is that maybe transitioning into that. Obviously, I do want to go over the Battle of France and politics, some themes that Gwen talked in, talk a little bit about how they shaped what was the greatest and most terrible war that we've ever had to go through as a human species. But and then transitioning that into the present in terms of what can we do with this information. So that's kind of what the board game aspect of what I tried to create moves into that, because you take what you learned in the past, and that's great and that's fun, it's really interesting, but ultimately that's got to shape how we live in the here and now, and that's the goal that the board game tries to really.
So you created a board game about the World War II, the Battle of France.
Yes, yeah.
And you've added a dimension that a lot of games don't, and that's the political aspects.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, we have a different kind of mindset about what a board game should do. Excuse me, about what a board game should be, and that try to replay the war, not try to replay exactly what's happening, but trying to put you in the situations in which they did. And part of that is definitely the politics of the time.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of that is definitely how do you respond to what your opponent or what the zeitgeist of the area is going of the time is,
right?
Because that's really what's important. It's not dates, it's not facts, it's not statistics. Cool. It is that, but also like it's how can we take this information? What were the circumstances that caused things to happen? That's really what we're trying to get at.
Yeah.
So I think that's
a perfect example. I won't steal any of your choices from France, but a perfect example of politics was Peace in Our Time with Chamberlain and Churchill over
the
in
Munich
England.
Conference.
Yeah,
right. Yeah. That's actually a perfect segue, honestly, into the history of the Battle of France, because I mean, if you want to talk about we talk about like Munich conferences, which were obviously when we look back on it, one of the biggest failures of modern politics in terms of the policy of appeasement. But if you look at it, like, interestingly enough, all of the major social commenters, the political commenters, consider it to be a great success. People consider that, Chamberlain had achieved what no one else could conceivably do, which is actually stop a world war. And so he was
– The blitzkrieg.
The blitzkrieg of the time. So it's funny that we – what was once considered this massive – success is now one of the biggest failures you've ever seen.
Right. Now, we got a question in the chat room.
Okay.
Asked if I caught it. I didn't catch it all, but are you thinking that we're going back to war is what I believe they ask you over there. That's better on the picture, guys. What was the question of going to war? You might want to type it in again because it flew by and I missed it. But I think they're asking if you think that area of Europe we're going to be in a war again soon.
That area of Europe is increasingly tenuous. I do agree that. But I don't think that – I'm not exactly – another Cold War era. Yeah. I think that could happen in the sense of the economic warfare that might occur through either us versus China or us versus Russia or us versus Japan in terms of the economics. Whether I believe that we'll have another nuclear arms race, the point where, you know, you have to have kids underneath desks and duck and cover, I don't think so, mainly because I think that we've already gone through that and we know that that's not
going to work.
That's not mutually assured destruction is not a viable thing that you can either sell to the public.
It did
or
work.
Other. Well, it did. It did work.
But it won't work
but
in places like Iran.
No, I don't think so. So economic sanctions, economic warfare, I think is going to be the new form of actual warfare rather than having to roll in tanks necessarily. I mean, I did a conference in Washington, D.C. on it was some form of defense and how the new wave of defense was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that one of the problems is that with all these digital tanks, the tanks have all the digitalized computer systems,
mm-hmm.
that cyber warfare, knocking out someone's infrastructure in terms of the electricity that is necessary to generate EMPs and stuff like that. That might be a new avenue of warfare that we haven't even really seen before.
And we practice that. We also – that's what I did in the Air Force. The last part of my career was – I was in electronic warfare.
Mm-hmm.
And we were in C-3CM aircraft, which is Command Control Communications Countermeasures. And what it did was we jammed enemy communications and stuff. And so these digital tanks, we'd shut them down or spoof them or make them turn on their enemy and stuff.
Yeah.
And so that's coming. And all you cyber hacker utes, you know, are going to hack these things. And I don't think we're going to see a Cold War where we build up a NATO and do it again like that.
Yeah, no, I think that we've kind of done that and realized with the consequences.
That was for its time.
Yeah, that was for its time. But a cyber kind of warfare, a cyber kind of tensions, at least, is definitely a possibility, especially given the...
More than a possibility.
Not more a possibility, honestly.
Kerry said that we're going to launch a cyber attack on Russia for it'll release in all of Hillary Clinton's emails.
Yeah, so, I mean...
Which is kind of dumb to admit that we're going to do it, but... Yeah.
That's not always the best idea to admit to your enemy what you're possibly going to do.
Right.
But definitely that will be the new wave, or either that or economic sanctions, although those seem to be... it's sometimes not wholly effective. You can see those two being the major possibilities of the new era of warfare. So that's definitely an interesting topic to think about.
I can still remember crawling under desks in the 60s as if it would matter. But, you know, we did what we were told. We were kids.
Yeah.
The idea was those metal desks would hold up debris that would fall on us, you know, and we might have a chance to crawl out. We really didn't. The myth that it was going to save us from nuclear attack is not. It's not really was a structural thing. They were, you know, made out of iron back then instead of plexiglass and paper clips like they are today. And the idea was it would give you a bubble over you.
Uh-huh.
But but I can still remember that was a weird time. The Russians, instead of crawling under desks, issued everybody a sugar pill. And told them to take the pill in case of nuclear attack by America and that it would prevent radiation poisoning. It was just a sugar pill, too.
Yeah.
But, you know, the public believed it. Boom shelters, exactly.
Mm-hmm. I think part of that idea for both on the Russians and our side is just to try to keep the fears down. Because, I mean, the public outcry would have been enormous if we knew even, like, what – I mean, in Russia, if they knew many of the things, that there would have been, mass panic. I think that part of the governmental – structure was to try to abate that and not to...
Well, ironically, it wasn't like America wasn't doing it to abate the fears of Americans about what Russia would do. It was deeper than that. And Russia, too. They had to control the emotions of their populations, both Americans and Russians, so that we didn't push the government into a war with our emotions.
Right.
And if the public was demanding it, the politicians, you know, they always run out and get in front of a parade. And so we were afraid. It was, and this is a model of the American Revolution, which is why it was successful. And the French Revolution, segue back to that, it wasn't. So we controlled our mouths, and they could not. So back to you on France.
Okay, yeah, so the, a little bit of a rocky transition, but back to France in 1940. So I do want to try to address two major misconceptions, which I find are fairly prevalent in the the zeitgeist of what people think about France. Is one that the actual French soldiers were really like we've even made a joke about this just to begin this debate, this little conversation, which was that the French soldiers are all cowards and they all ran away and mass hysteria, and that's true to an extent. There were 300,000 people who surrendered to a veritable division led by Heinz Guderian in June. But if you look at if you had French soldiers versus German soldiers in a fair fight, usually the French soldiers were able to hold their own on the majority of the times. The difference is in the leadership of the French versus the leadership of the German army. The French leadership, I have an interesting little anecdote about this. The French leadership did not necessarily trust one another very much. And because of that, they had this thing called Chateau Generalship, which was a man sits by himself, he writes out his own order, he sends it out to his own couriers who drives out to his own place, and he does his own thing. So this method of trying to get anything done was so haphazard that there was a time during the French battle where Maurice Gamelin, who's the French leader, French commander-in-chief, he's located in Paris. General Army headquarters was located in a very remote town called Montreux, which was 35 miles east. Mm-hmm. There was the field commander, who was located 12 miles west of Paris.
So that's not even on the field.
Not even on the field or in the direction of the General Army headquarters. And then there was the Air Force commander, who was just in a completely different location, 12 miles somewhere else. So I don't even know where he was.
because the planes fly from there to wherever the action is. So
that's the only one that makes any sense. But what you have to also realize is that none of these people are coordinating anything together, because they're sending messengers through couriers on motorcycles to each other. They're not even using radios at this point. So
an aside to that is that's what we did to the Iraqis when I went to Desert Storm. We shut them down electronically, and so their centralized command didn't work, so they split it out, and they put everybody on bicycles and jeeps and motorcycles to get their messages on paper out because they couldn't communicate.
And that just kind of harkens back to the idea of electronic warfare being so pivotal in the coming years.
And this was very effective because the French couldn't do anything.
So bad. In fact, there was one time there was a breakthrough at Sedan near the Ardennes Forest. I think then there might be some ideas about how Germany won, which was they broke through this very dense forest. No one thought they could do it. Mm. They pierced through it, and everyone just kind of went to the wayside after that. But there was one time in which they were trying to make a counterattack after the Battle of Stone. They built up all their forces, and then they were like, oh, wait, let's not do this, because the French were incredible. The French leadership was very indecisive. Let's not do that. And they pull all the resources back. But then they just forgot to tell an entire division that they just weren't doing the attack. And so this one poor division just went in by itself and got totally obliterated.
Yeah.
So, like, that's just a very minor example of just the entire war. It encapsulates a microcosm of the entire battle in terms of French leadership unable to accurately ascertain where the Germans were or how are their strength, and then they their dysfunction at actually getting anything done is just very apparent very soon when you actually study how things worked.
Now, the big Maginot lines were supposed to protect them, and so their entire philosophy was, we don't have to do anything, we're safe.
Yeah, the entire philosophy was the idea that if you can – and this is honestly – I give them a pass on this, because during World War I, the idea was very much you sit in your trench and you wait for the other guy to attack you, no man's land, you put up some barbed wire, you're going to be fine. And generally that worked out for the French. Generally it did. The problem happens is when you have this mechanized Theory of Warfare, the Blitzkrieg that we're going to talk about.
Which changed everything.
Which changed just everything in a single battle, which is why it's so interesting to kind of to study. So they built this Maginot Line, named after André Maginot, or I don't know. It's some French name that you can pronounce it any way you
Maginot?
Want.
Maginot?
Yeah,
we call it the Maginot Line.
That's a good joke. I haven't actually heard that one. I'll have to use that whenever I'm at my my European history party.
Well, there you go.
So the Maginot Line nearly bankrupted the entire French economy, building this massive structure of, I think it was 55,000 tons of steel.
Oh, that was incredible.
An incredible amount. And it like I've already said it like a couple of times, it nearly bankrupted the entire French economy.
Yeah,
and
for nothing more than a lawn decoration.
Exactly. In fact, I think it was only 17 of the 55 major fortification forts were actually taken during warfare. Everything else was just taken once they already collapsed.
Yeah, but they didn't take them in a frontal battle.
No, they only came
passed
from
them
behind.
And they came behind.
Right,
yeah,
came behind, and it was a very useless line in general, but mainly it was useless because they redirected resources away from what was needed, which was they actually French had a lot of good tanks like the Colossus B1 Bis, the Samoa 3A. These are decent tanks to begin with, but they didn't. Neither did they have enough of them. Or they did not have and they had enough of them in the sense they had like enough tanks to actually field an army. But the problem was they didn't have
the logistics
behind the tanks. The tanks themselves were fairly good.
Yeah, they just couldn't go very far.
They couldn't go very far. Exactly right. So the logistical supply arm that's so needed for you to feed a functioning army wasn't there.
And I don't get that because. If anything, you think the French would have figured that out because of Napoleon,
right?
Who you know, lost Waterloo and everything basically because of supply lines.
Exactly. Yeah. So you think that they have all, and especially at Borodino in Moscow, one of the reasons was also because they had to retrace their lines because of supply. So you think that
the Germans were learning that lesson again? Yes.
they will learn that lesson very soon. But so you just see that. It's not necessarily the fact they built it. The fact of the matter is that they redirected so many resources to something that was just outdated. It's not necessary anymore. And their air force. I'm not going to try to pronounce the Armée de l'Air or something like that. Yeah. I'm not going to even try to butcher that French. I'm going to offend everybody. But but that was completely, completely inferior to the German Stuka dive bombers, the German Heinkels and Messerschmitts, which were vastly superior in both speed and maneuverability.
Yes.
So you really see that aspect of preparation really factoring into how the actual battle was played out. The second misconception that I do kind of want to talk about briefly is we already didn't kind of touch on it briefly, and that's the idea of Blitzkrieg. Blitzkrieg, in my humble opinion, which admittedly
you're talking about my daughter's driving, right?
Well, that's one of the problems. Is the problem is that Blitzkrieg is often used to describe pretty much anything at this point.
Yes.
Like I've heard it used to describe football games. I've heard it used to describe people's teenage daughter's driving ability. I've heard it used in almost any context imaginable. And the idea of Blitzkrieg as just the tanks themselves moving in a fast and organized manner is not at all what the point of the German army, the German high command, was trying to make.
No.
The idea of Blitzkrieg is a holistic plan in order to use not only tanks but also air power.
Air support.
Yeah, air support, thank you. Air support in a concerted fashion to attack the cities and to attack the supply routes instead of actually engaging the enemy army. So part of this was like, why should we deal with just the actual army that's going to actually hit us? And you know, if we punch them, they'll hit us back. Shouldn't we attack the cities? We should attack the infrastructure and to where the citizens and the politicians are going to be forced to collapse. And this is a very different idea, really, since Sherman in the Civil War.
Yeah.
That's the first time of this total war is really used. Now, obviously,
Himmler and those guys said that they got the idea
from
Sherman.
Sherman, and you know, I mean, because Sherman was obviously very effective in getting his Tecumseh, which honestly actually was what we named the Sherman tanks after.
Yes.
So it's a little bit ironic in that sense.
It was one that they were up against the Blitzkrieg.
Yeah.
that the idea was to make civilians consider the price of war so bad that, hey, Agador, thanks for doing that, the price of war so bad that it would make its own government stop, which
right.
is why they had those bombings, you know. Like
mm-hmm. Right, yeah, and you even see that. There was a the German government got some flack from the United States press during the time when we were still technically in neutral, but we were basically the arsenal of democracy, which was, by the way, nice job, FDR, getting that passed.
Yeah.
But when we bombed basically the crap out of one of the Netherlands cities, I think it was, golly, I forget, Rotterdam or something like that. We just the Germans completely obliterated the entire city, and everyone in the United States was like, that is never been seen before.
Right.
Those were civilians. Those were kids. Those are women and children. Those aren't people you actually need to be killing. And sure. And the German mindset would have most likely have been something like, well, that's a warning to all the cities that are trying to oppose our Panzer divisions, which that's a symbol of what our strength is. Because the idea of Blitzkrieg was to target the cities themselves, the actual population areas, rather than just, I mean, the sexy part of Blitzkrieg is the tanks moving through. You mean you have these massive fleets of ships and they're
breaking through lines
yeah. and crashing. That like that's all the fun stuff that you see like in movies and stuff. But the actual real Blitzkrieg is the attacking of the industry, the attacking of the power line.
Your infrastructure.
That's where, and honestly, that was a very smart calculation by the German high command at the time, given that France was that one section they did not try to, you know, strengthen was their infrastructure, their logistical supply chain.
Mm-hmm.
So given that, it was very easy for the French to collapse in a relatively short period of time.
And if I remember right, the Germans blamed the French underground, the resistance, for why they were targeting civilian population points. But that was the pre-plan. That was the plan going in.
I mean, like what the ostensibly a country does during wartime and what its actual motives are vastly different.
They were spinning it while they could.
Yeah. So, but you definitely see that that the idea of Blitzkrieg is sometimes overused, and that's kind of one of the pet peeves of mine that I have when someone tries to there's an Army Navy football game and it was like the Blitzkrieg of
yeah. Even if they don't know what they mean.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'll admit I do that sometimes just to sound like I'm smart. You mean try to use
words
you don't know. You know what I mean? So talking a little bit about how this idea of, well, what does it really matter in the end? So what? I know perhaps the listeners know a little bit more about the idea of Blitzkrieg, but what's that going to necessarily do? How can I do anything with this knowledge? It's a little hard to explain it sometimes. It's just a group meeting of students from the senior class, from the high school class. We talk about the what's going on in the election right now.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the views of the candidates? We try to. It's an open style forum debate.
It's a nonpartisan.
Club. It tries to. You want to maybe address that, but. So the idea is that it's a nonpartisan club that tries to incorporate into a civic discussion both sides of the aisle, and we try to engage, and it sometimes gets fairly heated, but that's the point, right? Is to try to you know, strengthen your own views and try to through a little bit of a Socratic style of dialogue, or you know, you can see if you can try to persuade the others to your own positions. So I think that's really something that's burgeoning right now, and I think that's something that's really important.
So it's a
given.
It's like a symposium then, a debate
without
argumentative and angry.
Yeah, I mean, like obviously, given especially the nature of this election, it does get a little heated sometimes. But that's not the point. The point is to try to engage in a thoughtful discussion, especially on the importance of voting. The voting trends in America are, especially among young voters, is cratering right now. And that's really a problem.
Why do you think that is?
I think it's for two reasons. I think, one, the sheer size of the government is getting to people. When you have well, what I mean by that is 325 million people are in the United States. I'm not exactly sure if that's accurate, but it's at least 340. Okay, 340. Okay, yeah. Well, 300 million plus. Let's just say that. The difference.
Yeah.
And of those people, you're half of those vote, right? And you have to take out women and children. So not women and children, but like children and people who.
No, I think I agree with you. Women shouldn't vote either. Okay. You heard it here first, folks. Now he makes fun of his mom's age and that she shouldn't vote.
That is just a
Freudian slip.
Floridian slip.
Yes.
But okay. So you obviously have children and you have people who are, you know,
only about
who are not registered.
Yeah, they're eligible.
Eligible to vote, but
and then there's less because they're not registered.
Right. So only 50% of us, only 50% of Americans
could vote.
Could vote. Let's just say that.
And it's usually around 41-43% that show up.
Yeah. So what I'm saying is that even though there's a low turnout rate, that's still an incredible amount of people that are voting, at least 100 million, right?
Yeah.
150 million, right? And so I feel like that a lot of young voters can feel that their voice just isn't simply heard.
Yeah.
That especially if you're in – given the way that the Electoral College is set up, if you're a Republican in New York – what's the point?
Yeah.
I mean, you're not going to – I know that there's always the idea that, well, you want to swing your state. You want to swing your district. But it can get at times disheartening when you're – if you're a Democrat in Texas or if you're a Democrat in Idaho, I think it is, or it is really red, or if you're a Republican in Maine, you're not going to – you're less inclined to vote. So I think that's one major issue that you see. And also I think there's also the problem that many people have – sometimes they find it lengthy to vote. They find it a hassle. They don't know how it works.
Well,
they don't
fast
know
food
why.
Culture.
Yeah,
know,
especially – but yeah.
Can't do it in 1 minute. Don't bother.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, you know, I think I've heard one person in the club say, why can't we just vote on our smartphones? And it's like
– you know, all the fraud.
Well, there would be many issues with that. There's the idea that it's gonna take it's gonna take me 2 hours. So why should I? Or I don't know where to find any I don't really want to look it up. So there's many different ways and reasons why people don't want. I think there's even a bigger issue, and that's I don't think people think that it matters.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a real problem. Because voting was the main thing that we've been trying to strive for like millennia in terms of government. I mean, talk about feudalism in like the 1200s. You talk about like, you know, Thomas Hobbes's Leviathan in the 1700s. You mean the hereditary kings of France and Germany and England.
Yeah.
I mean, we've been trying so hard for so long since Athens to get our voices heard, and we seem to just be ignoring it. And that,
well, what about Tocqueville, since you're talking France?
I mean, yeah, that's another.
But I'm surprised, though, because, you know, the Democrats are always trying to sell the myth of free education.
Mm-hmm.
And most youths, you know, are excited about that, getting a free education, not being saddled with student loans and stuff. You're about to go to college.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be appealing to you to go vote Democrat for that?
I think that there definitely is a certain amount of populist or a populist undertones to that, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because there's a lot of people out there who are definitely encouraged by the idea of a free education, of getting. I think they also want to extend the insurance rates, insurance times what you could be on your parents' insurance to like 26, 28, something like
that. It's already 26.
It's already 26.
Obamacare,
okay.
Yeah.
So there is.
I guess these guys are afraid they're about to hit 30 and they're going to get kicked out of mom's basement.
Yeah, that can be that can be frightening.
Yeah, sitting in there playing board games.
Exactly. Who would want to promote such an idea? But there's definitely the definitely a certain aspect to that. But even amongst some voters who believe that way, you still see a – hello, my mother. There are definitely some ideas that voting is not going in the right direction in terms of young people, young youth. And I think that's really just kind of a shame. And I feel like that's something that we really need to address fairly quickly, because obviously if you're only getting 36% or 34% or, 42% of young voters, that's going to translate when they have jobs, when it is a pain to try to vote. That's going to be – you're going to see that even fall even further, and that's not something that we're
– and have a home that most of what they have. And instead of looking for freebies in government help.
That's definitely a hope that when you grow older, you'll definitely get out to the polls and definitely showcase your voice, because that's the point of government. That's the point of
really old people, like their 30s, right?
Yes, yeah, people who are
getting ready for their walker.
but definitely older than my age group, you do see better voting.
Sure now. Careful,
yeah, I know. Now, you do see better voting trends in terms of turnout.
Right.
But, you know.
So let's go back, because I am a fanatic about the Electoral College.
Okay.
So you kind of slid that in there. But let's not let that slide.
Okay.
Tell them thinking and good or bad.
About the Electoral College.
Because you're right what you said. You're not. I just don't think that's a good enough reason to move it. But
I am rather indifferent to the Electoral College as an institution, mainly because the Electoral College itself doesn't really change the vote as much as we think. So
right.
What I mean by that is they're faceless electors, very rare. So the Electoral College in and of itself does represent the people.
That's
so
nice.
What the vote in Texas is going to be the vote in terms of the Electoral College. So I'm not too worried about necessarily them trying to change or rig the election in terms of that sense. Whether it makes sense as a avenue to actually vote for president is a different discussion. If that's the discussion you want to get into, we can go through that. But the fact of the matter is, it's almost going to be politically impossible to get rid of it, mainly because small states are going to be so love the Electoral College because it gives them more power.
Hey,
like,
right.
I mean, Idaho and Wyoming.
Well, Obama could just do an executive order, couldn't he?
I'm not exactly sure in my government class whether that's possible. I doubt.
Possible, but it's not legal. the only way to get rid of Electoral College is to rewrite the Constitution.
Yeah, so it's...
You got to remember this. When the Founding Fathers set up the Constitution, they put the information of elections in a way that it can't just be simply amended.
Right.
Because
yeah.
This is a decision of the states.
Yeah, it takes 3/4
right.
of the states to be able
to
change
it. Right. Well, not just to amend, but this is how we elect people.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very clear that Congress is not in that job of deciding how everybody gets elected to Washington.
Right.
That comes from state legislatures. So mm-hmm. it's not simply an amendment process. This is something that would have to go through each and every state legislature from all 57 states.
Yeah, and that's frankly just not really – I mean, that would never – that's a politically impossible to do.
Well,
mainly because, like I said, the small states are
right.
going to – want to – geographically, they have, because of their statehood, have more power in the Electoral College.
You're
so
right.
So it would make them very little sense.
Well, I would argue the big states would too, because places like New York and Florida and Texas wouldn't want to lose their juggernaut either.
Yeah,
and so
exactly.
We all have things to protect. And that the compromise of the Electoral College was brilliant
mm-hmm, yeah.
on giving states, because you really think Trump and Clinton would be going to places? You know, they already don't go to Alaska and Hawaii because
yeah.
it's too far and too much.
Yeah.
And there are only 3 delegates.
Yeah.
But would they go to Vermont and New Hampshire and these places if the Electoral College didn't exist? It wouldn't be feasible. They would just buy commercials and move on, right?
Yeah, exactly.
They spend all their time in the high population areas because that's what counts is the population votes.
Right.
So I think it would change the dynamics, and I think it'd be another thing we'd have buyer's remorse where we would end up regretting what we bought.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. I mean, the only possible argument I could really see for trying to eliminate the Electoral College might be that sometimes I think it happened like once maybe that the actual popular vote did not match who the president was.
Twice, yeah.
Twice, okay.
Yeah.
So, so those are the only – that's the only main argument is that the popular vote just has one massive population surge in terms of –
But that only counts if you think the popular vote's what is important. You know?
Exactly.
The game is they all start off as a selection, and they all know that they have to come up with 240 electoral delegates to win. And there's a strategy – or 270, I'm sorry. I keep forgetting about the other seven states that Obama added to the union, because we got 57 states now. So the strategy is an electoral one.
Mm-hmm.
And if your candidate manages to get a popular vote but doesn't win the electoral, that's what we call losing, you know, because
yeah,
that wasn't the strategy. And,
right,
you know,
yeah.
And if that was – then you get what you
– yeah.
So, you know, the only people that would claim popular vote is people who lost the electoral vote. I think it's a separation of powers that the founding fathers put in, and the separation of powers isn't a separation of governmental powers, it's a separation of sovereign powers. And the electoral process was put in to separate the sovereigns of this country from the process, and it was to distribute our power throughout the entire country.
Right, yeah,
and
trying to prevent some kind of tyranny of the majority and also the tyranny of government.
And we didn't want a democracy.
We wanted
a republic.
Right.
And that is a step away from government,
from
being in charge. And
yeah, because inherently the founding fathers weren't exactly all too happy with giving the election of president directly to the people. That's why they had these electors, was because they thought that if we were to – that the popular population was to kind of mess up, we could there could be someone who would sweep in and kind of save the day with these electors. So many of the founding fathers did try to make that checks and balances on the tyranny of the masses versus how that actually plays into the government. So I think that's
well, we're running out of time, and I keep steering you off of what you want to talk about. So let's get back to whatever it was that you want to talk about.
So just talking a little bit, I'll just finish up a little bit on what the club really tries
to
do.
Your club, yeah.
Yeah. It's just trying. The first session of the club was just trying to tell us, well, why should we vote? I've talked about maybe why people don't, but why should we? And I mainly stress the idea that voting is an obligation to everybody else. Like John Locke and Thomas Hobbes both. Both argue that you engage in a social contract with people around you, and that social contract is something that you have to your government and to the people around you. Mm-hmm. And I said that your voting is not necessarily a right. It is a right that we give you, the government's given you, but it's also an obligation that you have.
Duty.
It's a duty. Yeah. And they're almost
– You said duty.
Just raising the bar of humor in this radio program, but the idea is that it's not like you don't, it's not like something you just get to pick and choose. Like this is something that you're obligated to do. You have an obligation to your fellow citizens to go out and vote. And I think it's interesting that every candidate is always telling his supporters or her supporters or whoever supporter there are that. Get out and vote. It matters. And yet
– Go TV is the most important thing to a candidate.
Exactly.
Get out the vote.
We have whole campaigns just that have whole sections just dedicated to getting the people to the polls. Make it as easy as possible. Tell you where they are. And yet people still don't, because I don't think people realize that it's a duty. It's a duty, and it's an obligation to your party and to your fellow people to get out and show your voice and be heard. I think that's something that we haven't really...
See, now I would slightly reward that because I have... but I agree with the premise 100%. Did I miss something? Something else come up? Oh.
Yeah, just...
Yeah.
The
idea of loyalty to the party I get concerned with, because the party is just a group of people that come together with like ideas, and they're supposed to be pushing like ideas.
Right.
And but we unfortunately today have... the two major parties who have managed to monopolize the electoral system.
Yeah, there's...
And they're more about party than they are about the Constitution or the idea of the platform that they have.
Yeah, you know, it's so true. I just tried to touch on this very briefly, but I went really into detail on this in the International Cooperation class. We talked about consociational democracy versus consensual democracy versus majoritarian democracy. And what you have is we have a majoritarian democracy sort of in here, in America, given the two-party system and the majoritarian way we elect the president.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the flaws of majoritarian systems is that you have low voter turnout because people don't feel that their parties – you get along party dogma. You get party lines are drawn. Whereas if you look in Europe, you'll have – you know, the UKIP party, you have the Green party, you have all these different parties.
60 parties.
You have 60 different parties. But part of that also, I mean, part of the benefit of having 60 different parties is that everyone can feel like they're represented. Like, some people don't feel like they're represented by either Democrats or Republicans right now.
Right.
And you
they
know
put coalitions together.
Right.
I think we're going to be moving towards that.
I think that's a good move because you might even see, like, there's no – feel kind of bad for libertarian supporters or Green Party supporters because their voice isn't really heard, given the fact that they're not.
Well,
I'm not saying that like that's what I'm
I
saying.
Get you.
Is, well, what I'm saying is that like their candidates have a far, far, far lower chance
of
getting elected.
Almost none.
Almost none. Almost no chance of getting elected. Now, whether
the brilliant thing is the two parties absorb all the good ideas of these of the lesser parties,
the
so they never get any traction.
Right. That's definitely
so
the
they
idea.
Win.
That's the idea.
It's like how the anti-federalists won by getting the Bill of Rights.
Yes.
You know, it's kind of like it's a backhanded way of winning. But
right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely correct on that. That the we have what kind of government do we have?
We have a democratic republic.
See, that's what I thought you were going to say. Now, what would you say if I told you that the correct terminology is constitutionally federated republic?
I would say that's very long definition.
Only one more word than you use.
I would ask you what's the major difference between what
okay
between a Democrat Republican what
what's Democrat mean?
A Democrat means that someone who believes in democracy in terms of
and what's democracy?
Democracy is election by the people.
Not everybody gets a vote. Everybody has to vote on everything.
Yeah.
So if you want to add paperclips to the government supply,
right,
you have
to
go out and vote.
That, yeah.
We already have voter fatigue when we vote two times a year. And
right,
people
exactly
are complaining it's too much. So
right,
I don't think a real democracy would work. And
no,
the founding fathers called it mob rule. They did not like
it
democracy.
It barely worked in Athens.
So I hate the word democracy for the same reason the founders did. We have a constitutionally federated republic. You take any of those words away, you lose the definition of government. You add anything to it, you're just putting icing on the cake. We have a constitution that runs our government, right? We have a – you're in her spot. Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
She's trying to hit her mark. you have a constitution which guides government, controls and limits it. You're federated, which we are no longer, but federation was a federated government of the state governments co-equal to the centralized government.
Right.
And we are a republic, whereas the sovereigns of the country, which are us, and that makes us unique in most countries – we pick people to go out and represent us, to serve us, to do the dirty political jobs that have to be done so that we can go
so we can go
lives
and get out with our lives.
Right. And that's so important. And most political science teachers don't even know that that's what kind of government we have. And they come up with all kinds of trying, you know, meritocracies, you know, mm-hmm. and other words that they throw in democracies. And I even have people that come on try to argue that we're in a theocracy because the Christian right runs everything. And you know, and it's just simply balderdash. What is on paper is a constitutionally federated republic. What we have in action is all the way different.
Right.
And I don't even know how to describe what we have because, you know, we have all these checks and balances and everything, but you have a tyranny out of the White House, which was enabled because of the progressives who came over as Fabian socialists and then sold us on a bag of goods to hire a professional class of bureaucrats to run our government. And so they're unelected, unappointed, and they have nothing to do with we the people, and they fall under the executive branch. And this is how we have all these regulations, where if you go out and spit on your land, it's declared a wetland to protect some snail that's walking across it. And so I think the fact that because we don't know we're a constitutionally federated government,
mm-hmm,
republic,
right,
then it's easier to allow other things. This is why they pushed that word democracy, the Fabian socialists did, which they were called progressives, is what they came over here and called themselves. And so they pushed all these words to change how we saw things. And then they passed things like, you know, the 17th Amendment and stuff. They got rid of us picking our own senators with our state legislatures and hiring them like representatives and whatnot.
Yeah.
And that changed the whole dynamic. Now, a reason I brought this up was I always like a chance to talk about Constitution of Federated Republics. It's something you can bring back to your class after you think about it.
Right.
But economic federalism.
Oh, yeah. We talked
A long way around, but we got there.
Yeah, we so just briefly, we talked – I talked to us slightly about the Harvard Summer School and the Cold War. And under the International Conflict and Cooperation class, I was required to write a
– what was that?
International Conflict and Cooperation class.
Do they like have pancakes too?
No, it's not the International House of Pancakes.
Oh.
That's a different thing. Although I did dine quite a bit at International House of Pancakes while I was up there because they have some really good French toast. Just saying, back to French toast. If you're at International House of Pancakes, don't sleep on the French toast. That's just an odd IHOP riff. at International Conference and Cooperation class, we had to write, and they would give it a list of stuff that I could write about, or you could pick something you wanted to write about. So I picked one on the fiscal federalism and its effect on jurisdictional inequality in developed and underdeveloped countries. So basically, in normal people's terms,
mm-hmm.
that's how does economic decentralization of government either help or hurt how money is distributed between jurisdictions? So I like to use the anecdotal evidence of Detroit. We have a certain amount of jurisdictional decentralization in terms of how this works out. So Barry Weingast in 1985 published something called How to Preserve Market-Preserving Federalism. And the idea is that if you allow
How to preserve market-preserving
federalism. It's basically It's something around that term. But anyway, he puts forth his 4 points of market-preserving federalism.
Uh-huh.
And if I can remember them correctly, they are to have economic regulation given to a jurisdiction, have a strict budget cap, to not allow trade barriers between jurisdictions,
right.
And allow freedom of movement of people. And so,
that sounds like that's already in the Constitution.
It probably is.
all those are points of the Constitution. Right.
But the idea is that if you allow regulation into smaller jurisdictions, mm-hmm. they can better craft policies and regulatory laws to fit that jurisdiction. So,
okay,
like
you're talking local.
Local.
The problem is that while that's all in the Constitution, the bureaucracies of the central government
mm-hmm.
are the ones that are over-regulating and controlling these things.
Exactly. So, so Weingast would say that inhibits economic growth.
Just today, I saw a report. They were talking about how cities
mm-hmm.
like Haltom City, where we broadcast out of, they can't put a school, an elementary school, without first getting permission from the central government
mm-hmm.
on whether or not it's in an ethnic neighborhood, if they have
mm-hmm.
the right amount of school kids there, the right flow of
yeah.
It just amazes me that a city in a state would have to look to Washington, D.C. to figure out where.
And he only does this in issue. So I'm not exactly sure about the social. But at least in terms of economic terms, he says that if you allow regulation to go to those specific states,
mm-hmm.
if one jurisdiction is doing a terrible job of something, you can allow these jurisdictions to have competition for people and also for businesses.
Mm-hmm.
So like I mentioned Detroit. Detroit had a run of terrible mayors, and eventually the city went completely bankrupt given the fact that the terrible policy making. And you also see
that they've all been Democrats. Mayors. I know that he's not getting into the politics, but
right.
we can't take that out of the equation that it's a certain mindset that goes with the job.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, all the automakers got out of town,
right.
and all the people got out of town. There's a mass flood of people just exiting Detroit, and you just saw desolation, and that's why you have all those.
It looks like Hiroshima after we drop the bomb.
Yeah, it looks terrible in there.
Yeah.
And so what you see is that's market-preserving federalism working, because once new mayors got in that knew what the heck they were doing.
No attention to the man behind the curtain.
Okay, there's that's
right.
There's not a real
curtain. Thomas Jefferson put a veil of separation right there.
Exactly. It's not a real one, but
no.
I'm going to pretend it's there.
Yes. You're young. You're computer savvy, right?
Yeah.
So what do they call that? A
Firewall?
Yeah, firewall. We'll do that.
All right, we'll put a firewall. Okay, but the idea is well, you got some decent mayors in there, and they're made more pro-business and pro, you know.
Less government, less
regulations over business. You saw automakers going back in there. You're right. Seeing some rejuvenation of the inner city. So what the – sorry. Yeah. Hey, guys. So the idea of market-preserving federalism is kind of shown in this example in terms of how the policymakers are able to be in competition with one another for businesses and for different people. And so by putting them in those competitions, you can kind of create good economic growth and good social policies, because any kind of bad leadership would get immediately voted out, or people or businesses would just simply move. So that's that's the short version of Barry Weingast's market preserving federalism.
And speaking of short versions, you only wrote a token 40-page thesis on.
Yeah, just a small little.
Well, that take you about an hour.
Yeah, just like 30, 40 minutes. Yeah, just about a couple of minutes a page, no problem. So, But yeah, it's all cited and stuff. It's got the work cited, I think, about 5 to 6 pages long. So definitely a, I wouldn't say it's a tome, but I hope to publish one on something like this in the future.
You know the neat thing about academic writings? I have about 50 published academic writings, and I imagine that's about how many people have actually read it, too.
Yeah.
But, hey, it makes you feel good.
It makes you feel good, yeah, exactly.
That you spent a year on a 40-page paper.
Yeah.
That 10 people read.
I think they've actually done a study that the average people who read scientific papers are like 4.
Yeah.
Yeah.
4%?
No, 4 people.
4 people?
No, 4 people. Because
yeah.
It's that technical and that specific that it just doesn't do you any good for anybody else to read it.
Right. Well, yeah, that's it. There's a new trend. There was a book in the 70s wrote called The Time on the Cross. And the short version is it's a theory that every country has its time on the cross. And everything on time, you know, slavery issues. But then they wrote a book for academics only. And it was a smaller book, but it was full of all the notes and background and things you could check. And so an academic like me could go through it and check everything that they said.
Yeah.
But they realized that laity would not want to do that. And so they wrote a book that was more like Roots than it was an academic tomb. And that's kind of clever, I think, to do something like that.
To publish two different kind of works on the same topic.
We'll talk about that book sometime else. But so tell us about your thesis and why did you have to write it?
What? Just in terms of time, so we'll try to keep this.
Time. You got to go. Oh, we're already over an hour. Oh,
yeah.
My goodness. All right, quickly.
So quickly, I've already discussed a little bit about it, but I said that there's 3 reasons why France fell. One was the dysfunction of the French leadership, their inability to coordinate an effective counterattack, and because of French army was instituted to thwart the German attacks.
For the threat that they faced.
Yes, exactly.
It was great for the threat of World War
I.
And that's something that it actually wasn't all bad. Because in World War II, when that happened, the American military learned that we always fight the last war. And that's all we can. We prepare for what we did last time.
Yes.
And so now we war game and we try to come up with different things.
Yeah.
And so it we're at least learning from those mistakes.
Exactly.
So your game is?
It is available for sale for people who already own a game called Axis and Allies.
Mm-hmm.
It's a variant of Axis and Allies. It has a rule book, it has a board game, a map itself, and a set of combat cards which factor in some politics and some different weather ideas which try to put you in the mind of the commander in terms
Don't blow over the politics. That's a big part of the game, right? Because it takes what's going on and all the people who made all these decisions, good and bad, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so.
All that stuff, which is really fun to make and really fun to play. And then that can be seen on France1940.com. You can kind of read all about it there. So that's kind of where that's at. And But that's only if you have like games like Flames of War, I think also is another one, or Axis and Allies, or war games, historical war games like that. Because I haven't minted my own pieces.
You just got the game going, so now eventually you can go and look at that. And China is begging to have some prison labor to make your game pieces for you. So
perhaps.
Mom must be proud. Are you proud, Mom?
There's a firewall here. So we can't. Yes. She can't see. And
well,
we
weren't talking about it. You were talking about her favorite son.
Oh right, yeah, yes. Exactly. No,
the one
that
yell.
Yeah, she's real proud.
So. Yeah, Mom's proud. Trust me, and she has every right to be. She raised two fantastic young men, who are productive members of society. And why, when I look at the youths of America, I don't see it as bad as a lot of people do. You know, these millennials and whatever, Generation Z's and stuff. But we got guys like this who, I mean, listen to him. What we just, he just talked an hour about stuff, kept up with me toe to toe, and he's a high school kid. Now, go to any of your local public high schools, and I defy you to find a student like that. You might find one diamond in the rough. But, my daughter, you know, was the same, going from All Saints, and Shawn Michael went to All Saints, and it's not just All Saints, but it's private schools and home schools. You find kids like this. This is not unique. This is ubiquitous in that environment, and so that's where the leadership will be coming from in the future. Those are going to be the people that replace me, because I'm too old to do this stuff now. And so they'll be replacing us in the decade. And my faith in America anything you want to talk about?
No, I just want to say thanks for...
Evidently,
thanks.
Your dad's hungry. And,
yeah. Yeah, he's coming back, but I... Thanks for...
Oh, me?
Yes,
oh, sweet.
Today is spaghetti on Friday, so it should be really
oh,
good
man,
today.
Spaghetti. You went all the way home for this?
I did.
Oh, God.
You hadn't eaten.
Oh, well, thank you. Yes, I've been eating junk since I've been in the hospital all week. At, you know, oh, that's sweet. Everybody, I got spaghetti and meat sauce. Yum. Well, thank you.
I just want to say thanks for letting me come on and talk about it. So I appreciate it. Thanks
yeah.
so much.
Is there anything you didn't talk about that we wanted to?
No, I think that's the thing, we got everything covered. So
yeah.
I appreciate it.
Well, let me know, guys. Want him back? I bet you do. Send me emails. I think it was a lot of fun. Yay. Amanda likes you. Amanda's in Haltom City, too, by the way. So that's a local. Yeah. Yeah, we'll come on anytime you want to talk about stuff. Now, your club.
Yes,
you
sir.
Didn't. You didn't talk about the club part of it. You just talked about talking.
Yeah.
You want
exactly.
to give them a plug?
Yes. So it's just, I mean, in terms of it's just like we just kind of meet at lunch. It's a very we try to have an informal, formal kind of setting. We don't want to try to make it too.
Okay. Let's be honest. You can't sit at the cool kid table or
exactly.
the football table. So you created.
So
a
yeah.
geek
exactly.
Table.
Exactly.
Yes.
It's like you just described my entire club better than I could have.
See.
In just about a sentence. So, I feel like we can just leave it at that.
Yeah, we'll just leave it there. So, I like that, yeah, because you guys are talking politics. Whether they're all conservative or all liberal doesn't really matter. The fact that they're engaged
yeah.
is what's important.
That's
yeah.
really what we're trying to.
And if you're
foster.
Receptive.
Yes.
To listen to other people's viewpoints. Too often we find everybody just waiting for the next person to shut up so they can make their point.
Exactly.
You know, and they don't really receive anything.
Right, yeah. It's trying to engage in a debate and
yeah.
engage in the actual learning. So that's the point.
And persuasive debate.
Yes,
yeah.
Yeah.
yeah. So it's like, right, Amanda
yeah,
says it's a discussion.
Yeah,
exactly
discussion.
Right. All right, guys. I would invite questions and stuff, but they need to hit the road. And Father Darrell, which is, of course, my preacher, he's been on the road. Did he go to Yale?
Offshoot of Dallas Theological Seminary.
Oh, we went over to Dallas. Oh, well, at least he still needed a passport there. So, yep, I have so many people talking online that and they think it's not okay. Yeah, that's true. Everybody thinks that their opinion, you know, we all believe in the freedom to have an opinion as long as it's mine. And I just happen to be right. But well, Shawn Michael, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Mrs. Pigeon, thank you for bringing
you
your
so
son.
Much.
This was a blast. We got to do more.
Yes, sir.
And if
appreciate
you want, I'll make an invitation that you find your counterpart in your club, and you can come on the show, and we'll do an hour discussion with the two of you.
Okay.
That would be fun.
That
yeah.
would be fun. All right.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
All right. Well, great,
appreciate
guys.
It.
Everybody,
right, yeah.
I am dead tired. I've been on the
hospital all week, so I'm going to call it quits too and say goodnight to everybody. This has been the Underground Professor Show, UGP Radio, copyright in the year of your Lord, 2016, via Contoodles, y'all. Bye. Bye, guys. See you.